Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
Welcome, everyone, to the July 2024 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together today. And I am Remley Crow. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, Michael Caduce, Dave Page, and Dr. Bill Toon. We are really excited to talk about today's paper. And just as a reminder for everyone, the article that we are going to be reviewing is Emergency Medical Services Management of Bronchospasm in the United States, a Cross-Sectional Analysis and Nationwide Quality Assessment, which was just published in Pre-Hospital Emergency Care. And as always, this article will be paired with a discussion in EMS World with our very own columnist, Michael Caduce. The column's called Journal Watch. I encourage you all to check it out, emsworld.com, under the category of education and training. I want to thank all of those who are here with us live today. I can see quite a few of you trickling in. As we begin, just a reminder, you can type in your questions into the Q&A box and we'll bring those into the conversation as we go. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our panelists on and we will kick off with a discussion. And first things first is this is a really interesting and important topic, the topic of bronchospasm, probably one that doesn't get nearly enough attention for how common it is. I was looking through some of the latest NEMSIS data and it looks like at least one out of every 10 EMS encounters has to do with bronchospasm. So the authors took to a national data source and their goal was to look at, well, if this is something we see really commonly, what does the quality of pre-hospital care look like when it comes to the management of bronchospasm? And so we've got Dr. Fernandez here with us to talk a little bit through how the authors set this study up and the key pieces and the key measures before we dive into exactly what they found. So Tony, I'll flip it over to you to go through a little bit of how did the authors take on this study?
Yeah, so I think this is a really cool study. And to highlight some of the points you made, taking care of bronchospasm and asthma, there's a lot of things in EMS where we wonder, have we made a difference or can we make a difference for this patient population? There are some things where it's clear that we can, and evaluating and caring for a patient that's dealing with bronchospasms is something that we do well and that we can do pre-hospitally at almost every level in EMS. So I think this was a really important topic to dive into, and I really like how the authors went about doing this. So as we go through, let's talk about what they wanted to do, right? So the idea, they had three aims. And they wanted to, first, they wanted to describe the extent to which EMS care met independently developed quality measures. And we'll talk a little bit about these quality measures going forward. It was really impressive how they did some discovery to find all of these quality measures. So we'll put a pin in that for now. We will get back to that. And they did look at quality measure performance based on level of care. So they looked at basic life support versus advanced life support for their first aim. They also had a second aim, which was to identify or to do a risk assessment, a risk standardization for the quality measure. So they wanted to look at performance at the EMS agency level, because we know that there's not just a provider variation, right? How your agency cares for patients is largely determined by medical directors and protocols and the like. So doing a study and accounting for agency level variations, really important. They checked that box as well. And then their third aim was to compare rates of completed pre-hospital interventions performed for pediatric versus adult patients. We know that we don't see peds as often in the pre-hospital setting, and they are a vulnerable and very important part of our 911 pre-hospital patients that we want to care for appropriately. But we don't get to see them all the time. So that could play a role in how these patients are cared for. I think the authors did a really good job of stratifying between pediatric versus adult care for these this patient population. So as we continue through, let's talk about how they did this. So they used the NEMSIS data set, and we talk about this NEMSIS data set quite often. It is a wealth of information. It's a robust data set. And the great part about this data set is it's delivered at no cost. There is some upfront work that you need to do to get this data set. NEMSIS is going to ask you to fill out a form that basically says who you are, why you want to do this research, what the analysis is for, and if you intend to publish. There's a couple other kind of questions that they put in that form, but that's the crux of it. This information is readily available, and it's open for use for investigators nationally and internationally. The authors make some good points about this data set. They used 2018 and 2019 for their sample, and they do identify that it is a convenient sample, and that is true. These data are voluntarily submitted to NEMSIS. In 2018, there were almost 10,000 EMS agencies across 43 states that submitted to NEMSIS in 2018. And then when we look at 2019, there were a little over 10,000 EMS agencies from 47 states. And the authors note that this represents about 44% of the total EMS agencies in the United States.
And I think it's worth pausing and highlighting, you know, well, I know we talk about a lot, but one more time on this show, the value of having a national EMS data standard. It really sets us apart from other fields. Having a united data dictionary, and that it doesn't matter which software you use, we all collect the national NEMSIS data elements in the same way. That's why if you switch agencies and you switch softwares, primary impression will always be primary impression. And there's fields that are just consistent that allow us to pool together data from over 10,000 agencies, as in this case. That also means that when there's a change in the national data standard, we're all going to feel that change on the front side as people who are collecting data in the field. There was recently a very large switch in the NEMSIS data standard from what we call version 3.4 to version 3.5. And one of those ways that if you're in the field, you've probably felt this, your dispositions have changed drastically. It was one field before, and we picked, you know, whether it was an assist or a transport or whatever that might be. Now that field is actually broken into four separate data elements with hopes of giving greater granularity into what's actually happening with the patient, with the unit, with the crew. And so breaking that out is actually going to give us a better look long run. But you know, the day that it switches over in your state, you might have this like, whoa, why did my software change? A lot of those changes actually happen because of the national data standard. And there are a lot of ways to influence that national data standard too, which I think is an important piece, but I won't dwell too much. It's just, there aren't too many fields like EMS where we have this ability to bring together data across the industry. And I know it said it was voluntary, but most states choose to opt into this, and it's at the state level. So it's not like an individual agency says, I don't want to send my stuff to NEMSIS. Over 47 states at this point are submitting to NEMSIS. So it really is covering the vast majority of the US.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that your points were well taken. I think this is important. And I just want to highlight how unique this is, particularly in healthcare. There aren't many fields who can say that they standardize data across the field. So really cool opportunity to do some really impactful research. And we'll continue to dive down this one right now. So we said that they looked at data from 2018 and 2019. The authors are up front. They did this really because they wanted to avoid the COVID pandemic and how the care changed based on the COVID pandemic. That was not a part of their goals for this study. So I think it was wise to look at before the COVID pandemic to assess care. And then This leads to some great follow-up studies, right? We can always look at what happened during the COVID pandemic. And now that we're hopefully, right, out of the woods there, there's a lot of follow-up we can do here as well. So let's talk about some of their inclusion criteria, right? How did they get to the population they were looking for? So they included 911 EMS activation. So interfacility transports, medical transports, things like that, those are not part of this study. They looked at patients that were at least 2 years of age, and they had to be treated and transported by EMS. And again, they make some good points about why they excluded folks or patients under 2 years of age. The diagnosis of asthma is unlikely in kids that are younger than two. And there are different ways that you treat younger kids. So they wanted to just cut it off at two. And they also had to remove patients that where they did not know the age if it wasn't reported or was missing for some reason. They included only patient care reports that indicated that they had, like you said, both treatment and transport of the patient. This goes back to some of the changes in disposition that Dr. Crow was referring to before. In 2018 and 2019, this was treatment and transport was might not have necessarily been as easy to identify as it is now. But the authors did dive down this road, and I think they did a great job in using just these patients. And their goal was, the reason why they did was because they wanted to minimize duplication, right? In NEMSIS, we don't necessarily have a identifier, a patient level identifier that follows the patient through the call. So there could be multiple agencies that run on the same call, and that would lead to some duplication in records. And they use just treatment and transport to try and reduce that as much as possible. Again, we were talking about suspected bronchospasm, and as with all research, right, the definition here is exceedingly important. So let's dive into this definition a little bit and talk about how they identified their patient population. So again, we're talking about suspected bronchospasm, and the way they defined this in this paper was the presence of wheezing as a symptom. And they looked at EMS clinical impression of bronchospasm or asthma, and they also looked at protocol use for bronchospasm or asthma, and they looked at administration of an inhaled bronchodilator. They included any patients with a suspected diagnosis of asthma exacerbation as an indication for bronchospasm, and then they made some important exclusions. They excluded any EMS activations where they could identify anaphylaxis as a symptom for patients, either in the patient symptoms, the clinical impressions, or the EMS protocol used. So I did promise that we were going to dive into how they identified these measures. And again, they kind of left no stone unturned, which I think is the best way to do this. So first they looked at the 2022 national model EMS clinical guidelines. These included recommendations for both EMS protocols and performance measures to assess quality. They looked at statewide EMS protocols, and they looked at some national clinical guidelines. And they also looked at some NEMSQA measures. The NEMSQA, we've talked about them a few times. They are the National EMS Quality Alliance, and they develop a set of measures that are evidence-based, and with the goal of being able to compare quote-unquote apples to apples throughout the United States. So before we dive in a little bit more here, where we actually look at what measures they talk about, I wanted to just open the floor to any of our panelists who want to talk about the importance of identifying these measures from a no stone unturned type of investigation.
I think that's a great way to put it, Tony. I'm a huge fan of the National Model EMS Clinical Guidelines. It's actually a document I have saved on my computer. I feel like so often, so this is a National EMS state or officials document. This is their third edition of it. So if everyone ever asks me, like, well, what should be a protocol for treatment of asthma, since that's what we're looking at, they actually have put together some recommendations. It's all cited. It's written by content experts. So it's a really robust document. I should look how many pages it is. It's a very robust document, but it's all itemized by protocol. So if you were looking for a protocol on delivery or complicated delivery, they've really documented it out. They made some updates in 2022, and I was reviewing it today. And so they updated their trauma resuscitation guidance for cardiac arrest due to traumatic cause. So just reading through some of the interesting points that they made. So if you're an educator out there, if you're a provider out there, this is really a standard document. If you have to ever design a protocol or make a protocol for something, they have a pretty robust system already set up in place. So this is a great document. I use it quite frequently. I reference it quite frequently. So if there's folks out there that aren't familiar with it, it uses the evidence-based guidelines. So really a great document that's out there. So.
Yep,
I want to echo
absolutely.
that. I put the links over in the chat just for people who may not be familiar with that project and also the Pre-Hospital Guidelines Consortium, which is an evidence-based project. And I think the just the way that they approach this, you can see that the last study that they used in there that they referenced was in 2005. On BLS units actually using bronchodilators. So I've been waiting for this for so long, actually, because and Dr. Crow can back me up. At every one of the workshops that we do, I keep going, somebody needs to kind of reconfirm some of the things that the Ontario Pre-Hospital ALS Project confirmed years and years ago, which is beautifully done, saying, these interventions by emergency medical services actually make a difference. And in the case of respiratory distress, recognizing respiratory distress, recognizing its severity, and being able to treat it, these things, you would think it's kind of a no-brainer. Somebody's wheezing and they have asthma, and you're going to give them a NAB. But I don't know that that's actually true. And so just kudos to kind of looking through it. I do wish they would have, from a researcher's perspective, I wanted to see a little bit more about what they were, what brackets of medications they were actually looking at. But the construct is very sound, and I'm really, really excited to move to the what did they find? So, love it.
Absolutely. And I do often bear the heavy burden of holding us up from the results while we talk about some important methods. So we will dive in a little bit more in the methods. So everyone, I know you're chomping at the bit to get to these results, but these are important things. The measures are up on your screen. And you can see the first four had to do with the documentation of vital signs, right? Which is tremendously important, right? We don't know necessarily if it's done if it's not documented. So documentation is incredibly important. We look at the authors look at respiratory rate, SpO2 and ETCO2. They all and then they look at a document the documentation of a full set of vital signs. Which this is another NEBSCO measure where they look at blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, SpO2, and they're looking at documentation at least twice during a call. The next four measures have to do with delivering an intervention. So supplemental oxygen for folks whose oxygen sat was less than 92. That 92 number is interesting. That's something that can be debated, particularly if you're in a state like Colorado. But I think 92 is something we can that is a good middle ground for an assessment like this. They looked at inhaled beta agonists and inhaled anticholinergic medications, and then they looked at systemic corticosteroids. So that really kind of looked at all aspects of care for these patients. And then they didn't just provide us with a bunch of percentages and things like that, which are absolutely important. But the authors dived a little deeper, and they looked at developing a logistic regression model where they could identify factors that may be related to the administration of inhaled beta agonists, or systemic corticosteroids. And in order to do this model, they excluded EMS agencies with fewer than 10 eligible patients. That was a smart move to minimize variation due to sample size. And then the models were adjusted for things that were plausibly associated with administration of medication. So they looked at patient demographics, they looked at clinical severity, they looked at environmental factors such as the community size and seasonality. And then, as we talked about before, they adjusted for the EMS agents at the EMS agency level by doing some clustering there. We won't dive into what the statistics behind clustering, but we will say that it was not only appropriate, but I think it was ideal for a study like this. And then they reported descriptive statistics, and they reported some 95% confidence intervals along with odds ratios. So before we do dive into all these results, I want to open it up to the rest of the panelists for any questions or other important things about the methods that I may have glanced over.
I think you did a great job, Dr. Fernandez and Dr. Crow, going over these methods and showing that these inclusion of these various measures were pretty broad in terms of not necessarily looking at very specific medications and more just trying to get a good picture and be more inclusive of the different treatments that we're giving. And the other thing I wanted to add, not exactly related to methods, but more in terms of the introduction and scope, is that, again, these respiratory emergency calls are super common, something like a tenth of our EMS calls, I believe you stated. But we don't often think about the mortality associated with them, that asthma deaths are very much still a very real thing, unfortunately. And the way I think about it is many of these deaths don't need to happen. It's often folks who maybe don't call 911 or call 911 too late or don't necessarily receive the proper treatment. And we know that there are these gold standard treatments that are in those EMS clinical guidelines that are part of that pre-hospital guidelines consortium group. So we know what needs to get done. And I think the study authors did a really good job of trying to make sure that trying to benchmark us and see that we're actually getting done what needs to be done, since there's still far too many folks that are dying of asthma each year. And I was just looking at the numbers before our webinar, and definitely asthma mortality has gone down from decades ago, but it's kind of stagnated over the past 10 to 15 years. And there's definitely room for improvement. There's a lot of disparities. And I think the first step in addressing asthma mortality and is knowing how good we're doing or not in terms of treating it. So I'm really excited to get to the results. So thank you.
I'm with you. I'm a little sad, I guess, because we had an opportunity here to report also the patients that are sort of in extremis versus the patients that are not as sick. In particular, it'd be really helpful to understand if basic life support, quote unquote, which I don't even know what that means anymore when an EMT has variances and is allowed to do all sorts of things with extra training. I don't like the BLS, ALS labels, and I wish we can drill down a little bit more. If these BLS agencies are rural and they're allowed to start IVs and they're allowed to do all sorts of other interventions, you know, maybe even give IM epinephrine in this case, I would have wanted to see a little bit more depth there. I think they had an opportunity while they were diving into this concept So I don't want to actually disparage them, because I think that they really, that particularly the way that they identify what the measures are, but I'm looking at the measures right now, and certainly waveform capnography is in there, which is really towards the more paramedic ALS side of the house. On the other hand, so is 12-lead EKG acquisition in these guidelines, and understanding how much, you know, CPAP and BiPAP BLS units are doing, as well as some of the more advanced epi, might have been, it was just a golden opportunity to say, just so you know, BLS is not always BLS. They're doing some other things in there that may not be in the scope. So anyway, let's move
on. I'll chime in the other direction on this. I like the approach that the authors took, and that they did stratify ALS, BLS, but that they didn't get caught on that, because this approach to me is the more patient-centered approach. Patient doesn't have an asthma attack, call for an ambulance and say, please send me a BLS ambulance. Patient calls, and we hope that the system gives them whatever resource they need delivered by whatever clinical level, as long as they get the thing that they needed. So I think that your question, Dave, is a really good one, but certainly beyond the scope of the three aims that were laid out. And I think that's a call to all of you listening. Hey, really great research question is still out there. But I do like that the authors for this first swing through the national data took a patient-centered approach.
Yeah, I have no trouble with that. I just wanted to know how many of those patients are in extremis, BLS or ALS, like not even the unit that responded, but just how sick they were. Meaning they, if you use epi as a surrogate for they're really, really sick, or even respiratory arrest and assisted ventilations. So some of these might have actually not, you know, if you can do an inline NEB as an example, that may or may not be part of your SOPs. But knowing that they were, that ventilations were assisted, might have been helpful to sort of stratify the how sick they were. Just the thought.
And I absolutely love the debate and discussion about the appropriateness of research methods. We could do this all day if it was up to me. But without any further ado, I think we should move on to the results.
Let's do it. First things first, I think we should check out figure one, which is generally in most papers, the flow of how patients actually got included in the study. And so you take a database like NEMSIS, which was already impressive, but when you see these numbers, it's really impressive. We're talking over 56 million EMS events from the combined 2018 and 2019 data sets. And then removing children who are younger than 2 years for the reasons that we discussed related to asthma is probably not going to be diagnosed that young in a child, and it's probably not the cause of any wheezing. Then removing anything that was not 911, so taking out interfacilities and the critical care interfacilities, those kinds of things. And then this decision to only look at the transported group was an effort to reduce duplication of events, so trying to count each event only once. And then we get into how did we find those patients using that definition of bronchospasm. And so the inclusion criteria here leave us with a total of over 1.3 million EMS events. That's a huge sample size. So my first gut check here is passed with, all right, do we have enough patients that I'm confident in these results? And then the next table we'll move into is So the next table is the characteristics of the patient population. And that will actually be table two. Here we go. No, table one. I think we're missing table two, but that's okay. I'll talk us through it anyway. So table two lays out who were these patients and what were the characteristics of just that group that got included. And so overall, it was 94% of the encounters were classified as advanced life support. And to Dave's point, we don't necessarily know what that means. Advanced life support in one system could be very different from advanced life support in another system, but overwhelmingly 94% ALS. 55% of the population was female. And the median age, here was an interesting one for me, was 66 years. And generally, when I've seen studies of bronchospasm, it focuses on that pediatric population, which again, maybe low frequency, but high criticality events. But here we see that over half of the patients included were over the age of 66, and only 4% of those patients were actually under the age of 18. So that's a good picture of what's going on. And then geographically, where were these patients? 83% were in urban settings. And so again, thinking that a smaller portion of this population is rural and might make for a great subsequent study to really drill into what does care look like in the rural setting where the challenges may be different and the resources may be different. And so with that in mind, this passes the gut check on, is this what patients with asthma generally look like, or patients with bronchospasm generally look like when they encounter EMS? The answer is yes. Overall, the vital signs here also show a population that isn't necessarily critically ill on average. And that goes to Dave's point, which I think is an important one of, I wish we could see who these patients were and who is the super sick population. The median on the pulse oximetry was actually 96. And so when we think about, okay, what proportion of this population may have even been eligible for these interventions, that's something for us to keep in mind. The median heart rate was 95, systolic blood pressure 140, and the median respirations were 20. So that gives us a great framework to think about who are we talking about when we dive into the performance measures, which I love that they took the wide section on the performance measures and just took a look at, well, how are we doing when it comes to recording these things? And a good performance measure isn't necessarily perfect. A good performance measure is something that serves as an indicator that we need to go look if something is out of whack. It's not going to tell us why a measure looks a certain way, but it does tell us that as leaders, we need to go have a look at this. So if we move into table three, this is where we get the individual level look at what is performance on these measures. This was each of those eight quality measures, starting with the ones related to recording vital signs, seeing that overall 98% of the records had a respiratory rate, 96 had an SpO2. But when we get down to end title, we see that that's only 29%. And I would wager that if we were to drill into which patients had end title, those are probably patients with advanced airways more often than not. Are we using end title proactively with the nasal prongs? Seems to be less common.
Remley, this table made me sad. Specifically, less than half of our BLS providers got more than two sets of vital signs, and barely half of our ALS providers got two sets of vital signs. And then even less got some sort of, when we start getting into the anticholinergic administration later on, no one's getting it. This table made me sad. This is such a common occurrence in EMS. We see tons of these patients. And the fact that we didn't get a second set of vital signs to even trend our impact, I sort of can understand capnography, though I have some other thoughts. But I was like, the vital sign thing really threw me for a loop. How did we not cycle another blood pressure, document another pulse ox? We can't use, I'm sure the excuse cannot be for all of these patients, we had a really short transport time. So
I would agree. And I'll add a layer of sadness to that since we're going through the swamps of sadness, it seems. These full set of vitals, the little A there means this is only on encounters where a medication was administered. So in theory, I believe the authors were looking for a pre-post set of vitals, but we performed an intervention and only have one set of vitals. So we don't know, or maybe can't show always so easily, that the intervention that we used had the desired effect. So I think that is a really important measure to hone in on. Yeah. And I see Dr. Toon's got a question for us.
Yes. So I think in relation to end tidal CO2, what I'd like to bring up is there's a cost factor. A nasal cannula cost about 50 cents, an end tidal CO2 non-intubated sampler cost over $10. And while it would be ideal that everyone, that would be just a common, as they call it, the fifth vital signs, it's not economically smart for an agency that is operating on the the margin, the edge, then they can't get that replaced. So I've never been surprised about seeing low end tidal numbers for, and as you said, if they're intubated, you want it 100%, but we don't know which patients here had advanced airways or bag valve mask or whatever, so or the type of sampling. But I always like to point out that sometimes, you know, even a BLS agency may not be able to afford an SpO2 monitor, you know, or they may not think that, oh, well, I can get one of these ones for $50 or whatever, you know, and if it gets broken, it's easy for me to replace. I think there's some things, and again, we're going back a few years here in time, and that's an impact factor. I think we always need to take those into consideration as the time of the study and the size of the organization could come to play.
Absolutely.
I was going to also add that along the same lines, of course, that nice to see these results, but definitely some disappointments as well, that just a reminder that this is only what is documented in the electronic patient care record. I know that was mentioned earlier, but that's something, especially when it comes to end-tidal CO2, for example, in my experience, looking at many charts with different systems, for some reason, the end title doesn't always get uploaded and somehow doesn't make it into the chart. Or when it does, it's only in the narrative that the EMT or paramedic writes that they applied the end title and this is what they saw, but it's not there actually in that drop down as the assessment or those readings. So I think that this might be sort of somewhat of a falsely low picture. So I'm trying to look at the glass half full rather than half empty. But I definitely know that end tidal, it does cost more than that cheap, you know, nasal cannula that's less than a dollar. But in these patients especially, I'd really hope that they're getting end tidal, since when we know that our EMS clinicians, maybe they're having a hard time listening to breath sounds in a loud environment, they're not quite sure if they're hearing wheezing or not. We know that end tidal, not that number, but just looking at that waveform can give us really good evidence as to whether our patient is experiencing that bronchospasm or not. So I really hope that they are using it. And I've definitely read charts where it's physically, where it's typed out, you know, what they're seeing on the capnograph, but not necessarily making it there to the actual upload or numbers where it would show up here. So that is unfortunately one of the limitations with this kind of work.
You know, you bring up a, I think that's an excellent, an excellent point on that. I just want to add on to that is a lot of agencies don't require their people to routinely upload the data from their devices. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a simple, straightforward call, you can just document it where you want. You know, there's not this rigid, hey, if you use the monitor, you know, this download the data. That was one of the things we had to work on a great deal in the, or when I was working, you know, full time, is we had to put a criteria out there. If you met this criteria, we wanted the download from the monitor devices and stuff. So, but that's also a factor.
Yeah, help me. I'm going to defend the EMS providers here a little bit, because if you're running around and you're busy and most of these calls were urban and you're going from call to call, sometimes the documentation doesn't really reflect the care, although we know if it wasn't documented, it wasn't done. So don't get me wrong. But I am wondering about I know in my chart, I can document that there was a patient improvement. And I'm wondering from maybe experts that are on this webinar, if that is part of NEMSIS also, that you can actually document that the patient improved, and why not use that in this particular project to show a subjective, but maybe very objective, the respiratory rate appeared, you know, less labored, or the respiratory effort was less labored, even if the lung sounds still, you know, sounded like they had wheezes, I can visually see the patient pinking up a little bit, that is more subtle and would be caught in a narrative that wasn't analyzed in this particular metric. I think there are other ways we could have gotten to the patient improved after they got a NAB.
Sure.
No?
And that is a NEMSIS data element on the improved, unchanged, got worse after any intervention. There's also an initial and a final patient acuity to see if the patient's condition improved from when we got there. But that doesn't account for their baseline status. So if the patient was not incredibly sick to start with, and now I know that the goal of this was to find bronchospasm, but the way that the definition was cast pulled in a lot of patients who just had a primary impression of asthma. And it's unclear whether or not that patient needed treatment for this impression of asthma. They didn't all necessarily have wheezing
bronchospasm
present. And yeah. So that's another study that could be done. Hey, calling all
researchers.
I know. Narrowing in just on that population.
Let me tell you, PCRF is having some workshops coming up. There's some coming up.
But I think that is important. So we could narrow in on that population that truly had documented wheezing and say, this is the sicker group. Did they get the interventions?
Yeah.
And I do want to talk about.
It's the middle, right? It's not the super extreme, super sick, and it's not the really not sick that much that they just didn't take their inhaler. It's that sweet spot of the patients who struggle that might end badly if not caught early. That's the one that I'm super curious about, that grabbing that middle side and whatever. I don't even know what I'm saying, but you know what I'm saying. Getting the patient that's not yet as sick.
I think that's important. And when we think about that improved, unchanged, got worse button, is where did we start, right? Unchanged might not be a bad thing.
Yeah.
But also, I do want to address the documentation concerns, because I think it kills a lot of really good quality projects or gives us a justification for not taking a further look. And again, a good quality measure is one that signals us to come take a look. It's not putting blame on the clinicians. It's not putting blame on anything. It actually takes a system to fix this, not a person. So coming in, and if I see that, you know, my documentation's at 9%, is that good, bad, or indifferent? I don't know. I need to go look at a sample of those records where the thing was not documented and see, is it just written in the narrative? Was it truly not warranted? And maybe I should adjust my measure definition. All of that's really informative. And if the measure makes us go take a look, it worked as intended. Now, the authors also have in the prose of this manuscript, it's not in any of the tables, so it's important that we read the full results section. I think this might be the most valuable data in here, is the agency level performance at the median and the interquartile range. Let's take that end title measure as an example. The 50th percentile of agencies, so of those 10,000 agencies, half of them were below 9%, half of them were above 9%. But even at that top quartile, meaning that only one out of four agencies performed better than this, is 33% got end title CO2 documented. So if I'm at an agency and I see that my measure's at, you know, 3 or 4%, well, my agency is below the median and way below that max, that higher quartile of 33%. So it gives me some ground to work with and to start thinking about my own performance and whether or not I need to adjust. If we decide that 9% is good enough, that's totally fine too. The goal on this is not always 100% on these measures.
I'm going to challenge a little bit. Remley just explained it in a really good statistical way. I want to bring it back to realism. The fact you're busy would not be an excuse in the hospital for not doing something or documenting something, right? So if you're in the hospital, are we okay not giving the sepsis patient busy?
I'm with you.
The excuse...
You want to document it.
You want to do it. And I think the concern here is we don't know whether it was documented or not. The perception may be that, well, they did it all the time. They just didn't document it. My understanding of the real world is that's not true. So oftentimes it's not actually being done. And I would say if my family was in the hospital, I'd want these documented. I want these vital signs collected. So I think sometimes we give the excuse of, well, they were just really busy. We don't give that excuse to the people in the hospital or the clinic. We should hold ourselves.
I get it. I'm just coming from a space that where honestly, sometimes it's hard to upload. Sometimes I got the pulse ox off of the finger probe in the house and I didn't write it down on the first go around. So I was actually just now, while you were talking, looking for the definition in the paper of what they call a full set of vital signs. Because if you're telling me that I also had to document temperature twice, that might not happen because I'm not too worried about temperature. But I do see where in table one, they do list the numerator as blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, SpO2, and you would think that those four things could be documented, although respiratory effort might actually give you more detail. I might actually document some of this somewhere else in my chart. So it's not, it doesn't make it right. I'm not
And it's not to say like that there's not a reasonable exception. So the measure's goal is to get somebody to go take a look. And if I were, you know, your quality improvement advisor, I come in, I look at your chart. Oh, okay, it's here in the narrative. I can give credit for it and I can focus on what are the barriers to documentation and take a systems approach to that. But ultimately, my concern moves from clinical care to documentation, which is a much better place to be in. But these large scale studies like this hint at there's probably a clinical thing going on as well, especially when we get to the pancreas plots, which I'm going back to the world statistics, but it's reality too. So get ready. These pancreas plots are really telling, and I think they give us a good way of doing benchmarking, a responsible way of doing benchmarking. I have a soapbox and it's called benchmarking because I think we do it poorly. We often use a benchmark just to say, am I above average? Well, good for me. Yay, I'm done, right? Wrong. The right way to do benchmarking is to look at those who are doing really, really, really well, the top box, and go after what it is they're doing. So when we look at the figure two panels A and B, this is the risk standardized beta agonist administration. And we can look at, you know, the median here is somewhere around 75 or 78%, the red line there. But we can see all of these agencies that are in green who are way above that mark. And some are even at 100%. So if I were undertaking quality improvement project, I really want to know what are those agencies at the very far right of this graph doing? And what could I emulate or rip off and duplicate from them to get that level of performance? I shouldn't settle for this, you know, 70 whatever percent, 78%. So I think these graphs are really important when it comes to looking at an agency level benchmark that makes sense for my organization and not just being content with the median. And here again, for corticosteroids, we can look at, and we can have a whole discussion clinically about corticosteroids, which I think the evidence there is still pretty mixed on whether this is a true benefit in the pre-hospital setting. But when we see the median there is about 20%, but then there are agencies that are hitting above 80, 90%. So it is really important to look at this. And again, the purpose of a quality measure isn't to tell us the root cause or isn't to say that we're doing a bad job or blame somebody, because I can hear the chatter out there. Well, what if it wasn't in their protocol? Okay, well, the root cause of this might be the protocol. And maybe the test of change that we do is to modify the protocols. But I think that these figures in particular give us a really helpful starting point to understand what does the lay of the land look like today and what might be different tomorrow? And then I'll move to the last results section here and hope that the panelists will continue to come in with their comments. But this is just the breakdown by children versus adult patients. And again, a lot of the focus on asthma research has been on children, but it is nice to see it split out here because there are different drivers and different aspects that play. And the authors do a really great job in the discussion of going through some of those challenges or the barriers that might be different. For example, IV access in a child, especially a very small child, could be more challenging than perhaps in some adults. So when we look at the performance of the quality measures by pediatric versus adult, in the cases here, we see that the performance among children was relatively lower. And so that is an area for us to focus on. It's something that we encounter perhaps less frequently, but important criticality here when we think about administering supplemental oxygen to people with an SpO2 less than 92%. Only 61% of children had this measure met versus 75% of adults. And so that's a pretty big gap. And, you know, I'm interested in hearing from some of our panelists who focus on education on, you know, where do we work this in our continuing education? Is this a knowledge gap or are there other barriers at play? Because education only works if it's a knowledge gap, but maybe there's something else going on.
I think that's a great question. And I highlighted the entire paragraph that explained this table because I thought it was all incredibly valuable. I thought one of the things that may be playing into this, and it's something we try to do on the continuing education side, is when the AHA made their oxygen recommendations for STEMI and stroke patients, right? Like it's only 94, 99. We don't give it if they're breathing okay and their oxygen's fine. And I wonder if part of this is a swing in the direction, right? We try and educate people. If they look short of breath, they tell you they're short of breath, just give them oxygen. It does it for a respiratory patient. It's not the STEMI or the stroke patient where it can be so detrimental. And I wondered if you would have done this study 10 years ago when everybody got oxygen as like prior entry to the ambulance was your nasal cannula, if we would have seen anything different here. So it makes me wonder a little bit about that too. I think you could probably make an argument on the pediatric patients. Some of the pediatric patients are a little bit tougher to get oxygen on, similar to the IV. And I think sometimes we step over that because again, the IV is a much more difficult task, but the number of kids I've had that have not wanted to wear the device. But yeah, I don't know. I struggle a little bit with the supplemental oxygen in patients who are short of breath. 75% of the way. We can definitely do better here. Again, I wonder if it's an educational problem. We swung the pendulum all the way to one side, but we certainly have some opportunities to recognize for improvement here.
And this is a call to the listeners to go look at your own data for these measures. These are pretty simple measures overall. Look at your own data and see if we can identify some of the drivers. And the way that we find those drivers is reading a few of the full charts of ones where the measure was not met, not with the intent to punish an individual, but with a question on the system. So if it turns out I didn't get an SpO2 because I don't have a pediatric pulse ox that's going to fit or will give me a valid reading, that's, you know, a system problem that can be addressed. And this goes along nicely with a pediatric readiness project that is underway, saying, do we have the resources we need to best meet the needs of this patient population? But here again, there's no blame. It's just a curiosity as to, well, what are the things that we could change as a system to get different and better results?
Yeah, I was also thinking the same exact thing about why are we seeing this gap? And then looking at pediatric and adult in terms of supplemental oxygen delivery versus inhaled beta agonists, I saw, okay, in adults, both 75%, you know, sounds, I could see they're, you know, right at around the same mark. But for pediatrics, we're seeing that a higher proportion are receiving those inhaled beta agonists. They're getting that nebulized albuterol essentially compared to the supplemental oxygen. And I was thinking that this might be a matter again of that equipment, pediatric equipment. As you were just talking about pediatric readiness project, that giving that supplemental oxygen, we traditionally think of a face mask. So it would probably be a pediatric face mask, whereas that inhaled beta agonist can definitely still be through a pediatric face mask, but often we're giving it through that T-shaped device, which kind of can be used, you know, universally, both for adults and children. And the vast majority of these calls, again, are adult. So we're very familiar with our adult equipment. And if we could repurpose the same exact adult equipment for pediatrics, we're going to be much more inclined to use it than if we're scrambling, embarrassed, trying to find the pediatric equipment. So I think that might be potentially what's at play. Definitely not an excuse, and definitely a call out to do better, but still that could be part of the explanation.
Yeah, and I think my call is, you know, not just do better, but get curious and take a look at our data. You know, because I think it's very easy to sit here and say, well, it could have been this, it could have been that, but it takes a lot of courage to go into our data and read a chart and see, oh, maybe like we are missing something, or maybe our protocol or scope of practice doesn't support getting the right resource to the right patient. So this is a good time for us to take a look at our data, get curious about, well, is it the measure definition that needs refined, or is it, you know, actually a gap in care that we can act on? And in a few minutes here, I do want to talk about a couple of the potential limitations that I think are important for us to consider, and especially as we think about, well, what are the next studies? One is the inclusion of transport only. So from previous research, we know that a lot of patients who have an asthma exacerbation are not necessarily transported by EMS, and that differs across different socioeconomic status and different racial and ethnic groups. So I would like to see, you know, and maybe a separate study or a spinoff of what happens with patients who are not transported. And then again, with the, I don't think we brought this in the conversation actually, but I think it's worth us talking about, is what happens when a bronchodilator is given prior to EMS's arrival? And was that contemplated here, or is that something that could potentially be explaining some of these findings? Is we get there and the patient has just taken a dose of their inhaler and seems to be improving. But these are two of the things that I saw, and I'll open it back up. We have just a few moments left, but for any other thoughts from our panelists before I will carry us out.
Really good point about that non-transport, since that was definitely a big piece of the pie that was excluded. And we see that a lot where folks are maybe out of their inhaler, we give them albuterol and they're feeling a lot better. But what worries me as somebody thinking about what's next is that if they're not getting that steroid, if they're going to the hospital, they're eventually going to get that steroid, they'll be watched. But if we're leaving them at home, I think they absolutely need to get that corticosteroid on board. And I'd be really curious to see those numbers for the non-transported patients. I know we're probably not going to start an IV if they're insistent on staying home, but we know that a lot of these corticosteroids can be given intramuscular or potentially orally. And I think this is a great opportunity for medical directors to maybe step in. For example, in my agency, we switched from a corticosteroid, which could not be given orally, to one that can be given IV, intramuscular, or orally. So all the ways in order to just get it in and give it to your patient. Exactly. More dex.
I love the comment in the chat, and get ready, because shameless plug, we received a record number of research abstracts for EMS World Expo International Scientific Symposium in Las Vegas this year, and one of them that was done during a PCRF workshop. So please go to prehospitalcare.org, look at the workshops coming up. One of them was on administration of steroids for asthma. So stay tuned and participate.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the ways you know that you're reviewing some really good research is all of the questions and additional research projects that come out of the discussion of the research. And I think we have that here to a large extent. I think the authors did a really good job of setting the stage and allowing us to say, well, you know, what if we did this next? And what if we did that next? And there's a lot of open real estate, so to speak, for investigators to jump in here and answer some of these questions that we discussed today. So kudos to the investigators who did this research. I think it's a great first step to answer a really important question. And while there is still a lot of work to do, I think this was a ton of work, and well done.
I echo Tony's sentiment on the kudos for doing this work. This is, I think sometimes we go into research being a little bit afraid of what the results might show. And the authors have to step over that barrier to really articulate the data. The one thing that I also would add into it, then I take away, and the next question I have is this whole Atrovent thing. So only about 1/3 of patients received an anticholinergic, yet a substantially higher number got a beta agonist. So oftentimes when we're nebulizing those two medications, we just do them together. It's a duo neb, and that's pretty common. I'd be interested to read more about some of the agencies and see how many of the agencies are just doing the bronchodilator instead and not the duoneb. I don't know that there's a good rationale there, but I'd be interested to learn more to find out what it is. So that was the next question that I have, is we need to do a little bit more on just the anticholinergic versus bronchodilator. So kudos to the authors.
I couldn't agree more. And I think a lot of good research brings about more research questions with this, which this one has certainly done.
So I'm going to chime in. And again, the authors did a great job, you know, compared to my days of sub-Q, epi, and aminophylline infusions, you know, so that's how we treated asthma patients at one point. But I think I don't think enough attention is paid to providers in two ways. One is the technology is not always easy to enter electronic data information. It can become very time consuming, and it doesn't flow as easily as it wants. So I always think that it, regardless of how the documentation done, the old paper or even electronic now, I think very few people use paper type stuff. But I do think it's important that it still isn't intuitive. It doesn't go along smoothly or quickly, and it can't necessarily be done live, you know, right at the patient's side. And the other part is I don't think a lot of effort is put together to teach actually what the fields really mean and what their definitions are. I know they're data dictionaries. You know, I know, Remley, you put a great deal of effort into the data dictionary at ESO and stuff, but it's not universally known. Sometimes you say data dictionary and people just crank their head and don't understand. So I do think that it's a twofold process that may exist here, but the authors did a great job and it'd be neat to see more work done in all of the areas.
Absolutely. And I appreciate those comments as system level changes that we can really focus on. And so that'll be my parting words, is for us to use this as a call, take a look at our data, but with a systems lens, not with this goal of punishing a clinician or say, how dare you not do this? Let's think about what's giving rise to those results from a system perspective and what we can actually change. And with that, we've reached the end of our time. I want to thank everybody who has joined us today and those who will be listening afterwards. As a reminder, we've got the Education Research Journal Club podcast coming up Friday, July 26th, and we will be back here again next month, second Monday of the month, August 12th, same time, same place. Really appreciate you all with your great participation and your feedback, and look forward to talking with you on the next one. Thanks.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.